Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Jersey Draws, cartoonist, teacher, comics teaching artist. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 264 of the podcast with Jersey Draws, creator of Boulder and Fleet, an amazing webcomic about a bear and a bird and a whole lot of adventure. Jersey is my go-to when it comes to making comics, talking comics, and nerding out over comics. He hosts a number of really outstanding podcasts. He's one of the faces behind the Ann Arbor Comics and Arts Festival. And I'm just going to come out and say it. He has one of my favorite voices to listen to. It's time for you to get to know Jersey. Here's episode number 264 of the podcast with Jersey Draws. Welcome to the podcast, Jersey Draws. I'm so excited that you're here, man.
I am super excited. I'm a big fan of yours.
Oh, you're blowing my mind. Stop it.
No, I'm serious. And it's also, you know, it's like it's an honor to be like in the company of so many stellar guests that you've had on the show. I feel like I finally made it.
You finally made it, Lord. I feel like you finally made it onto the recording because we've been trying to do this forever.
You know, that's the problem with doing interesting things is that it becomes exceedingly difficult to fit more interesting things into them.
We're both, and I think I mean to say this word the way I'm going to use it, we're both like full-time podcasters. We have a busy plate of, I mean, just talking to people, you put a lot of energy into conversations and then to dress them up all nice to be able to share them out on your podcast host is a thing. And so you are a person that I know very well through a lot of my cartoonist friends are all buddies with you. And you're doing really awesome stuff. And so I'm glad that we get to talk because one of the things you and I have never talked about in the times that our paths have crossed is that I love Boulder and Fleet. And it's actually one of the select webcomics that I share with my kids. I've been working on using webcomics in the classroom. We write mini comics. We do a lot of stuff with comics in my library. But Boulder and Fleet is one of them, and Star Bunny is one of them. There's just a handful of comics, but because when you're with them for such a short amount of time, there's not much you can read aloud to kids. But it's so fun to be introducing them to webcomics. And also the Comics Awards that you and Dave Roman and others have done are really, I think, connecting not only librarians with great books and kids with great books, but you're building a platform for conversation, which is so exciting to talk to everybody about comics and not just great comics, but let's talk about print comics and historical comics and best hair in comics and ridiculous things like that. I love it all. So you're a hero of mine for the way that you champion comics for our kids.
Oh man, that is just too sweet. And I can't tell you how happy it makes me to hear that there's somebody out there using the Boulder and Fleet comic with their students. That is exactly what I hope for. You know, I mean, it's tough to make comics for kids on the web because the web isn't the safest place in the entire world, right?
That's right.
And I've had a difficult time in the past 10 years or more, you know, trying to make comics aimed at young people and find an audience for them, because in my experience, I teach comics classes in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and so I work with ages, you know, like 9 to 12 is my youth class, and then like 13 to 18 is my teen class. And it's around 13 that they suddenly become aware of web comics. But before that, they really don't. The YouTube is the platform that I notice those kids really get most of their content from.
Yeah.
And so, but that's my audience.
Although I will say a lot of them do have, when I point back to webcomics, when I do introductions with these kids, the place I always go back to is Wimpy Kid, because they all played on Pop Tropica.
Oh.
And in between those games, that's when Wimpy Kid would pop up before it got published. It would pop up there. And that was just maybe even while it was still published, because definitely book one at least was there, that you could read it as the webcomic that it was created as, Jeff Kinney created it as. You could read it there through Pop Tropica.
Oh wow.
And then it got picked up. And then it became the thing that it is on Abrams. but I point back to that. Hey, remember when you were in first grade and you were playing on Pop Tropica all the time and that comic popped up? That was this. So
wow.
It's hard, I agree, that it's very, very hard to just send children somewhere.
Yeah.
What helps as a librarian is that you are curating good comics. So
yep.
That we could say, here's a list of ones that as we revisit your awards year after year, you become an authority on those comics. Dave becomes an authority on those comics. Certain people become authorities. And so we know, okay, these comics are going to be safe, quote unquote, for our children.
Yeah.
And when I say that, I mean, you and I talked about this when I was on Galaxy of Super Adventure, we were talking about reviews for books. That to get into a library now, you often have to have your material professionally reviewed, appearing in School Library Journal or Booklist or LMC or something like that. But otherwise, it just becomes really important that there are eyes on those materials before they get in the hands of children, because books get challenged. And when books are challenged, it creates an awful lot of heat for schools, for librarians, for funding sometimes. I mean, it's something that we as librarians, I always want to fight for books. I always want to make sure that I'm fighting for my readers and that they get to read what they want and they have choice. But I want there to be a library for them to choose from.
Right. And you're talking about bandwidth too. You know, it's like, this is something
that's true
with
too.
Librarians a lot, is that like, there's no way you can read everything that's out there, you know? And so those lists and those awards, the award ceremonies, award shows, and different kinds of, you know, accolades that come to books. What's the one in Texas?
Bluebonnet and Maverick. Yeah.
Yeah. Like things like that, that helps. I mean, that you got to rely on things like that with the amount of books that are out there as a way to, you know, curate and whittle it down so that you can make a better investigation of these things, so that you can make better informed choices for your kids. So for sure. I mean, and then, you talk about challenging, things get challenged. You don't have the bandwidth for that either. So anything that could prevent that happening is a good thing as well.
When you say teach in Ann Arbor, are you teaching at the public library? Are you teaching classes that kids sign up for that way?
I used to. I did that for about 7 years at the Ann Arbor District Library.
Because your wife, I think, works there. I remember reading that somewhere, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah. My wife, Ann, works at the Ann Arbor District Library, and she is a selector of comics, and she's instrumental in putting together the Ann Arbor Comics Arts Festival that happens there every year.
Oh, nice. The reason why I remember that your wife is at the public library is because at some time, probably on one of your podcasts, you mentioned about the cool stuff that they can check out at your wife's library.
Yeah.
And that stuck for me, that, oh, they can check out knitting needles, and they can check out Wacom tables. And so, yeah.
And Wacom Cintiq digital tablets.
that's crazy. Expensive stuff that you're able to check out. And imagine, like, to be able to have access to materials like that, materials that you might never have a chance otherwise to be exposed to. That's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's the Ann Arbor District Library is a very, very special place, and I'm lucky to have access to it.
So where do you teach now, then?
I teach at the Ann Arbor Art Center, which is actually just down the street from the library. But my classes there kind of took off, and it's like there's more demand than I can even keep up with anymore. So I've been trying to get more cartoonists to go to work there, because there's definitely an audience for more and more kinds of comics classes.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so great to know that there are, not only is there an outlet for kids to go to classes like this, but that interest is obviously, of course, it's so high. Any person working in a library, or maybe even just any parent with a kid that reads, knows how much kids want to read comics. My son and I now, I don't want to say transition from, he's reading picture books with me, which is great. But we haven't gotten him into beginning chapter books yet. I keep waiting for him to be into Bad Kitty or be into Magic Treehouse or something like that. Mm-hmm. But instead, in like the greatest upgrade ever, the thing he's into is reading Mr. Pants by Scott McCormick, or reading Hippopotamister by John Green. Like, wow. he's reading comics with me and asking to read them over and over. It's to know that the comics are reaching. They're reaching kids at all ages. That's great.
Yeah, that is super, super exciting. And as somebody who's been a long time advocate for comics, you know, doing things like the Comics Festival and teaching comics classes, I remember a very distinct feeling in 2001 where it really felt like the industry was in such trouble that it might not be around in 15 years. So
really?
The fact that it's still around and doing way better than it ever was before, is super, super gratifying.
So what saved it? What made it just a couple good graphic novels around 2001?
You know, I remember exactly the moment where I felt like, whoa, wait a second. Something interesting is happening. It was when the first Babysitter's Club by Raina Telgemeier came out.
Even that early, I was going to say Smile, but I was going to go to Raina. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So like when that book came out, it was a signal to me that, oh, the traditional book publishers are paying attention to comics. And the traditional book publishers have access to children, right? And if we don't get kids reading this, right, if we don't get kids reading comics again, then this current generation of adults who are reading it are going to grow old and move on, and there might not be comics anymore. That's how it felt to me, at least. Because, I mean, you have to remember, like, comics in the 80s went through this whole thing where they were like, comics aren't for kids anymore. They're not for kids anymore. They're for adults now, which was a growth that I think needed to happen in a way, because like it was really like the medium and the people in it were trying to legitimize it to the mainstream public. But it took the Babysitter's Club books to show that, oh my gosh, there's a market here for this stuff. And when I saw that the traditional publishers were, you know, paying attention and making more stuff, oh, now they got, you know, Bone, they got Kazu Kibuishi. I was like, okay, I think things are going to be okay.
Yeah. That's a good call. Good call that it's those traditional publishers are, when they showed their confidence in comics, that was the change. I wouldn't have even connected that, but you're right. Marvel, Image, all the people that were and are still producing comics the way they are, it really is the. I mean, think of the reach that Scholastic has. I mean, you have book fairs.
You have the flyers. But the second thing I thought of, and this is not me, I'm really not trying to pay lip service to you or to your listenership. This is something I've said on my own podcast for years, is that the second thought that occurred to me was, oh my gosh, librarians and educators are now our greatest allies. Because traditional comic books, the pamphlet comic books, didn't get carried in libraries, or they don't often because it's really hard to shelve them. And plus, they're not going to last long compared to a hardbound book, right?
Right.
But this Babysitter's Club book is perfect bound. It's going to stay on the shelf. Kids are going to read it dozens and dozens of times. And librarians are going to see that. They're going to see the CIRC numbers, and they're going to get more of that stuff. So we need to make sure that librarians know we're here and that we are their ally, right?
That's a good point, too, to know that we're here together, that we're working together. And I wonder how many people working in comics, well, maybe now it's becoming a point that it's hard to ignore, but I wonder how many people working in comics, having grown up on traditional comics, see libraries in that way because they didn't necessarily grow up in the library versus, like, I think of, like, It just it makes me think that they almost have to work even harder, because an author will grow up often reading books, and so the library was a home for them, was a place for them. But here, a lot of you grew up in comic shops.
Yeah.
So we're sort of bringing you to another place.
Right.
Bring you into the library, which is a neat place almost for us to discover each other and discover, like, we have this collaboration that's just starting, and it's exciting to think, like, well, imagine what we can do together. We're just starting this relationship now.
Yeah. And it meant that cartoonists, I felt like a lot of us had to step up and become more like traditional book authors, in that it's not enough for us to sit in our studios and work by ourselves. We got to get out there, and we have to advocate not only for our stuff, but for the medium itself. And we have to put the friendliest face we can put on this thing, because comics has been through so many bad times, like in terms of public opinion, the Frederick Wortham years, right? That let's not screw it up this time. Let's do a really good job this time and make sure that people understand that we are an approachable, generous, friendly group of people who really do. Our mission is perfectly aligned with yours, in that we want as many kids as possible to be excited about reading.
Yeah. I think you're to know, and hopefully this is something that people making comics are starting to see and own, because it's something in the library that I hope all of us are starting to own as librarians and as teachers, is that comics now are becoming one of the first things that kids read. Specifically, we always talk about reluctant readers and how comics are so much easier to approach because they rely on that transliteracy. I have the opportunity to read the illustrations alongside reading limited text. Mm-hmm. The text can be complex, but it gives me context by looking at the illustration that I can know those words and understand those words. Yeah. To have that in your back pocket, but also the fact that comics are read over and over and over.
Yeah.
I feel like there's just so much. There's so much going for good cartoonists making good comics and getting aligned with a publisher that wants to get you into libraries.
Yeah.
All those things. It's a good time. It seems almost cliche to talk about this golden age of comics and the golden age of picture books that we're going through.
See,
but
not,
you know what? It's amazing
to
be a kid.
At all. That is,
I think,
not
it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. I just remember how scary 1999, 2000, 2001 felt to me as a cartoonist. And I can't say enough kind things about everybody who's involved in comics right now.
Yeah.
It really does feel like a truly tremendous time. So much so that when you were on the Galaxy of Super Adventure, I remember asking him, like, when's the bubble going to burst?
Oh, yeah. It's not going to burst. Well, I think that more, I don't know, there's so much on your side. I think about all this stuff on your side, that right now, the next wave that's going to happen, and I know that, I still can't get this out of my mind, that I know that comics have awards. I know the Eisner Award is respected. I know that that's a thing. That's great.
Yep.
But I still feel like we're going to have ALA recognize comics in some way. Not just that comics can be recognized in their awards already, like El Defo has been, and like others at other comics have been recognized in their Caldecott and in their Newbery and in different awards like that, and the Prince Award, American Board of Chinese, of course, was famously recognized. The comics can make it in there, but I still think we're going to see the American Library Association recognize comics on their own as a format for telling stories that deserves that platform on its own. Of being recognized that way. So I just feel like we're going to see it just grow more and more. And as we do, as that time happens, the thing that I talk to you all the time about that I'm excited about is that my readers now are going to start writing comics and getting closer and closer to being published. And those comics are going to be influenced by the comics that you all are creating, which you were creating this thing now that didn't exist when you were kids. So my students are going to be creating things that didn't exist when they were kids. That's exciting.
That is super exciting. And the things that they're just going to take for granted as things that we had to really align ourselves to and adjust to.
Well, look how easy it is too, that the kids now, they have this online presence. I want to go to talk about Boulder and Fleet. And I think it makes a lot of sense to talk about it this way because of the online presence and the way that kids just make stuff online. Mm-hmm. My friend Blake, who does all the wonders with me, Blake was saying the other day about these GIFs and how do people have time to sit down and make these GIFs and the time it takes and whatever. And I said, Blake, you know that children crank out like 30 of them a day.
Yep.
Because it's no time for them. And there's tools for them to make these things. And it makes me think that same thing that you're making webcomics. And as soon as kids are reading them, and more kids are reading them, and the right kid who is online and is creating stuff online and then sees that, oh, online is a place that I can do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think as a child, a lot of that is exposure. When you see something, it allows you the not the permission, but it allows you to realize that, oh, this can be made.
Right.
And
there's a possibility.
I can be the one to make
this
it.
This is an option.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you started Boulder and Fleet, what, 2014, right? It was about 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
I haven't read every single one, but maybe I have read every single one. To have a webcomic, to me, sort of perplexes me a little bit because of the... Maybe you're about to tell me that you know where Boulder and Fleet is going for the next 5 months or something. Maybe mm-hmm. you know that trajectory, but to create something and share it, whatever your schedule is for people that make webcomics, sometimes it's once a week and sometimes it's a couple pages a month.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing Boulder and Fleet weekly, correct?
Correct.
So when you started, did you set out to just have it be something that stays and exists? Did you set out to, I don't know, make it be a good practice for yourself to be writing regularly?
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. I mean, I knew that it was going to be in addition to, right? It was not going to be my main gig. I don't have any publisher behind. I have a Patreon now, so I have financial support from my Patreon supporters. But when I started out, I didn't have any kind of financial backing, so it had to be a sideline gig, which meant I had to be judicious about, A, how much I could produce in a given week, and B, what its function was really going to be. What am I doing this for? I'm doing this for expression, because I'm doing a story without any kind of editorial oversight, so I get to do exactly what I want to do. It's practice. I'm checking in once a week on a thing. It gives me something to talk about to promote myself as a cartoonist. Hey, everybody who likes stuff that I do, I have a new thing. Any interesting or any publishers out there who want to see that I can ship something on a regular basis, here it is.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
There's that aspect to it as well. And then there was also the fact that I knew when I was done, I would have an artifact to print and sell. I'd have a thing that was all my own that I could take to conventions, to, you know, book fairs and ALA.
Yeah.
Right. To really showcase, okay, I have these other books that I've done, but this one is my heart and soul. This is like everything I wanted to do in comics because nobody told me I couldn't, you know?
Yeah. And I think too about the endurance of, well, you and I as podcasters, I think about that endurance of creating something because you as an artist feel the need to keep going because you are expressing yourself because you know that over this journey, you're going to change, and that's something you look forward to. You've been podcasting for years. I've been doing it for years, mm-hmm. and we've changed. And there's something beautiful about changing and knowing that in 3 more years, I'll have changed again just from the people that I've spoken with and the experience that I've gained.
Mm-hmm.
You've changed over Boulder and Fleet, am I right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can see the difference in page one and page, like, I think page 77 drops this week.
Okay.
You could see a big difference in the current story, or even in the first story I did just as like an experiment in, I want to say, 2011. I was actually, you know, I was freelancing, I was podcasting, I was drawing comics, and I said, can I fit one more thing in? I'm going to try to fit in an 8-page mini comic, I'm going to do it in a week, and I'm going to try to squeeze it in amongst everything else. And I set the design constraint of, I can't have any preconceived ideas. I have to come to the page blank. So I sat down and I drew a bear, and I was like, okay, well, I've got a bear. I like bears. Well, maybe he's from a family of bears. Maybe there's 5 bears. And I drew all these bears together. And I'm like, oh, that's 2 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So I'm like, okay, well, what does my wife like? Well, my wife likes birds and she likes bears. So what if I put this bear and this bird together? And then like that literally was how the story began. It was just me like just frantically trying to come up with something that my wife would want to read. And then for the course of 5 days, I drew this 8-page mini comic. And then when I finished it, I thought, is it good? I don't know. I worked hard on it. And Dave Roman, of all people, it was Dave Roman who like really responded to it, like very vocally, and like was telling everybody, this is an amazing comic. And then he turned to me, he's like, you really need to do more with it. So I was like, okay, well, I put more thought into it. And then it became the webcomic.
Nice. And the webcomic now, as you said, is up to page 70-something.
70-something, yeah. And the current story is going to end at page 88, and then okay. Move on to another tale.
And you'll publish the current one somehow?
Print it? I'll get it printed through like Amazon CreateSpace or something like that.
Oh, okay.
So make it easy as possible for librarians to get it, because I know that you guys have your own set of design constraints in terms of how you get your books.
No doubt. Yes, we do. And they're being circulated by my school, 800 kids, over and over and over. They gotta be able to hold up, especially when it's a book that they're gonna love like this. That we, need to be able to hold it up. Why don't Jersey? Do you mind sharing with the people listening just your pitch for what Boulder and Fleet is?
Okay, sure. Boulder and Fleet is the ostensibly about a bear and a bird who go from town to town and try to help people. So like imagine Calico Critters or Sylvanian Families mixed with the 1970s, early 80s Incredible Hulk TV show, right? But what it's really about for me, what it's aboutness is that it's my exploration of the hero who refuses to fight. Because I have a very, very big soft spot in my heart for the Superman type of character, the He-Man type of character, the guy with all the power in the universe, and that presents him with the conundrum of he must then be the gentlest person in the universe, because if you have that kind of power, to use it in any other way but with absolute restraint makes you a monster. So it's this bear with incredible strength and this little bird with incredible ambition trying to make a living for themselves as adventurers for hire. And Boulder doesn't like to fight, but if you're an adventurer for hire, you're going to get into situations where fighting seems like the obvious choice. So he always tries to find another way out of it.
In a recent-ish comic that you did with them, page that you did with them, you gave Fleet this line that I think it took the entire series to get to hear, but it's like the most prophetic line that I've seen in the comic, and I love it. To contextualize this, there's Boulder and Fleet are underground, and there's these crystal people that have really awesome names like Sapphire and I love it, and it reminds me of Mega Man. And I know you and I can get into like talking about all of our influences as children, and when I read this, that's a lot of what I like, is that it's, I know you're the same guy that I was growing up, and I like that. And I like that our kids are those same kids, and whatever. This comic is made for the people that like cartoons. Anyway, so this essentially this giant slab of rock is coming down, and rather than having it crush everyone, Boulder jumps under it and is holding it up with his great strength. And just as Fleet is saved and is coming to the side of her friend, she says, "You know, we wouldn't get into these jams if you were just a little less good, buddy."
Yeah,
that's the best. That's the best line. I went back and marked it. I was like, I remember.
Oh, thank you for noticing that. Yeah. She agrees with him, but she doesn't have to like it.
Yes.
Because she wants to be, in this particular story is like exploring this whole idea of like, what does it mean to be famous and what do you have to do to be famous?
Yes.
And Fleet has been expressing, some frustration early on in the story with how it's like, we got a real money problem and we need some higher paying gigs. I mean, if we're going to be adventurers, we got to be like big adventurers. And then, of course, they run into villains in the story who are after the same thing, where it's like Sapphire wants to be the most famous bandit in the entire universe, right?
Right.
So you get to explore that idea. But ultimately, no matter what, it's always about this bear and this bird who really care about each other, right?
Yeah, and I like that.
That's what it should be.
Yeah, and over the time of knowing these characters, well, it started off day one that you could see that you wanted that focus to be there. But continuing on with making sure that that is intact, that these characters care about each other before everything else, I think is a really good treatment you've given to them.
Oh, thanks.
I like it. I like it, Jersey. I'm a fan. I don't know how else to say it. I'm like getting all silly over here, feeling like, guys, you just need to read this, because if you read this comic and you like it, then that means you'll like me too, because Jersey wrote a comic that I feel like I identify with.
That's, well, to and going to the like the influences, yeah, like you said, like it's like we both grew up in that period of time, and
we did.
You know, like I've made no secret of the fact that I love comics as a medium more than anything, and I tell my students I'd rather read a good comic than watch a great movie any day of the week.
Yeah.
But my chief influences are the cartoons we grew up on, right?
Yeah, and you tap into those influences so well. I'm so impressed with so one of your podcasts, Galaxy of Super Adventure, Ben Hatke and Zach Giolongo are on there. And the way that you three remember and tap into those things is really wonderful. I mean, it feels to me like you're keeping your thumb on those influences, just keeping them at the forefront of your mind and paying homage to them left and right. It's just great.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, yeah, I think about it a lot. I think about He-Man probably too much.
Fair, fair. Did you hear the what's the podcast? I shouldn't have brought it up, and now I'm not gonna be able to remember it. They did a He-Man episode though. I'm gonna look it up while we talk. Anyway, yes, you've got a ton of podcasts going though. You've got good people in said podcast. Oh, it's How Did This Get Made? Of course it's How Did This Get Made. Do you listen to How Did This Get Made?
No, but now I need to.
On the Earwolf Network with everybody, with Paul Scheer and Natasha Leggero and tons of, anyway, great comedians. Jason Mantzoukas, and they just talk for an episode about how a movie got made. Like, how did this happen? And He-Man was one of them, and it was like one of their greatest episodes. I'll have to link it in the show notes. It's fantastic. But yeah, it's wonderful. It's you would love it as a fellow podcaster. How Did This Get Made? He-Man. Yes, I know your great influence with He-Man, the way that Zach has been so deeply influenced by the Ewoks and things like that, which is just great. But to then have it be, I don't know. So here's the other thing about our generation. We're at this place now where, regardless of the way we grew up, it is a very vivid memory to me how I was made fun of for the things that I liked when I grew up. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous to say it wasn't safe to like the things that I liked. That's going too far. But I went from in as late as third or fourth grade playing on the playground, imagining that we were Bowser and Mario and Mega Man and all of the Nintendo Super characters and Sonic and all of that, basically Super Smash Brothers before it was a thing. And I remember sort of just being laughed at, and I remember my friends growing out of it. And it, to me, to think back and go like, that was fourth grade. I was really deep into it late, because I teach the kids now, and I think like, I don't see any of my kids that often playing things like that. But, to be now in a place where to have unique interests don't feel so unique anymore, because it's so easy for us to talk to one another and to see online that we're not the only people in the world that like Doctor Who or that like whatever, name the thing that you think is quirky and only you like. And it turns out that there's a whole faction of people that like it, and because they like it and you like it, they'd probably love you as well. And so that's a
good point. That's a really good observation, is that yes, even kids today are way more connected than we ever could think to be. And yeah, I grew up in a really rural town. I mean, like, there were literally 25 kids in my entire class, 250 kids in the school, right? First grade, I was in a little yellow schoolhouse, like Little House on the Prairie. It was like probably built in like the 1920s, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, so it was very, very removed from everything. And to be a kid who is like really into comics, really into cartoons the way I was, could at times be... I don't want to, like you said, it wasn't like it was dangerous, but it definitely put you in a social stigma at times, right?
Yeah.
And like real heresy, I remember in first grade, I went to school for show and tell with a Strawberry Shortcake doll. I loved Strawberry Shortcake, and I was like, I want to take this to school. And my dad, bless him, said, you know, it's like kids are going to say weird things to you. If they say something you don't understand that makes you feel weird, say you don't believe in stereotyping.
Oh.
And I'm like, I don't know what this means, but I'll say this magic word. Well, it wasn't that magic. It didn't stop the kids from pointing and laughing. You know?
Mine was Care Bears.
Oh,
to,
yeah,
like, an older age. To the point that my wife now, like, still teases me. She's like, oh, yeah, you still want to get, or you want me to get you a Care Bear for your good grades? Because it used to be that my mom and dad, like, when I got straight A's on my report card, we would go to the arcade, and they would give you a token for every A that you got, and then they would get me a Care Bear. That was, like, a thing that they did.
But let's be objective. It's bears who live in the sky who come down to help you whenever you feel kind of down. That's
and they're
the greatest
nice.
Thing I've ever heard.
I know. You're
how could you not like that?
Are you objectifying me for bears that are nice to people?
And their chief weapon is laser love.
Is laser love. That's right. See, those people growing up, they don't know. They grew up probably to be horrible people. They make lots of money, but it's okay. I'm poor and I have passion. Well, I'm glad that where I was leading with that was that how great it is that you, well, all of us being these types of people, but for you specifically to be in front of children with these comics classes that you teach and to be this passionate about the things that you love and to not hide it, because I think it's that continued environment, that sustained environment that allows children to keep being these great, amazing kids that they are, because they don't need, they have nothing to hide.
Yeah.
I mean, they have something to hide. They're, kids are still cruel, but yeah, it's a little safer.
They definitely can be. And then I spend a decent amount of time in my teen classes establishing ground rules for engagement with things, right? There's certain language that doesn't get used in my presence. You know, there's certain kinds, like we do not make fun of something somebody else likes. And I'll tell you why, because that's a bad cartooning skill. Because if somebody else is excited about something, that's a notification to you that there's something that people are connecting with there. And even if you don't like it, you should unbox it to find out if there's tools in there for you to use in your work, right?
Yeah.
There's a practical element to being a good person.
I like that. A practical element to being a good person. I like that, Jersey.
Huh. Well, that's the way to get through to 13-year-olds anyway, in my experience.
So in the way that you continue to connect with children and make comics, you've got this amazing comic award that we're coming up soon on. Are we coming up on nomination? Or on, no, actually coming
yeah,
up on.
Nomination should be announced pretty darn soon. You're talking about the Kids Comics Revolution Award show.
No doubt.
Yeah. Which... So that was Dave Roman. You know, Dave instigated the whole thing. And as I would be a fool to say no to anything that Dave ever asks me to do. And so when he said, like, do you want to help with this thing? I was like, you bet. I've got the platform. I've got the. At the time, the show was called Kids Read Comics, but now this year we changed the name to A2CAF, the Ann Arbor Comics Arts Festival. And this will be our fourth year running the award show, where we put out, Dave assembles a nomination committee to nominate from 2015 comics for various categories, whether best hair in comics, grossest thing in comics, favorite cartoonist author, you know, favorite adventure story, favorite humor story. And then we put it out to the kids vote on it. You know, we print up or we make PDF ballots that teachers can download, and then they can mail them in. And then we also have an online ballot where we encourage educators to let their kids all vote on this thing anonymously. And then we tabulate the votes Saturday night at A2CAF, and then Sunday afternoon we announce the winners at an award show where we often have people in costumes and puppets and ghosts and Ghostbusters and all sorts of nonsense.
And it's broadcast, too, or at least you film it.
Yep.
And then share it. Because I remember seeing, I at least watched the archive of, was it last year when Vordak was there?
That was 2 years ago.
2 years ago, okay. I'm sure I saw the other one from last year, too. But that one in particular, I remember showing to children and being like, look, this is a thing that happens. It's awesome. And your awards, the Lego awards.
Yeah. So mythic. The Ann Arbor District Library is a very supportive partner in this whole event, and so they get the award trophies for us. And you know, every year they ask us, you know, what kind of designs would you like on this year's awards trophies. And one of the years we had the Lego guys, Lego
right.
trophies on brown bricks, like the certain color brown to match the Kids Comics Revolution logo. What I didn't know was that was a very rare color of brick. And George O'Connor of the Olympian series won that year. and he was so excited about getting the figure because it had that color brick on it.
Nice.
It was great. He shot a video of himself talking about the award. And also, I mean, like, how cool is it as an author to get an award that you know was voted on by readers?
I was just going to say, we have a state book award that is student selected as well, that just like the way you do this award, that Dave puts out a call for librarians, teachers, parents, everyone to nominate books. What are your kids reading? What should be on this list? What are favorites? What are things we should know about? And then we turn to the kids and let them vote on whichever categories they want. It's not like they're required to vote on anything. It could just be, well, you read these comics and now, you know, you've got more things that you can read, but let's vote for your favorites now.
That's awesome. That is the best. I mean, as a person who makes comics, that's exactly what I want to hear, right? I want to know that any accolades I get are directly from the people that I'm trying to service.
I think so too. Yeah. And I think that those are the kids that it means so much to them when they come up and get to see you, because you're the one that has that magic power of drawing that character to life and of telling those stories, and that they've fallen in love, I think, in real ways with your books and with your stories and with reading because of your books. And so when I try to watch whenever I can, whenever I go to a book festival, by the time this posts, I will have gone to the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is just outside of DC, which is near me. And Dave will be there. And it's always fun to watch kids approach any author or illustrator with the book to get signed. But often it's just like they're in awe that there's a person behind that thing that they love. And I'd love to think it's because then they realize that they're people too, and they can be people behind making things.
Again, it's about presenting people with options.
It's right? That. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think I remember very clearly what it was like to be that age. And probably because I spent a lifetime, you know, remembering what it's like to be that age with, like, you know, my fascinations in terms of entertainment. But it's like one of the reasons I love The Hero Who Refuses to Fight was because I remember as a child being nervous, afraid. I was smaller than the other kids, kind of thing. Mm. That whole thing, you're a nerd, and that kind of stuff. In the time when that didn't mean a good thing. And I remember you living in a rural community, strength and power and might means right was kind of like a unspoken rule, right? If you're the biggest, toughest kid, you kind of can get away with whatever you want.
Oh, no doubt.
And then in the late mid-80s, two characters showed up on two of my favorite cartoons. On G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, a character named Lifeline showed up. And on Transformers, a character named First Aid showed up. They were both medics, interestingly enough, but they were both pacifists. And they were very brave, but they refused to hurt people. And I remember, fifth grade, it hit me like a thunderbolt. I was like, whoa, wait, it doesn't make you weak to not want to fight? That can actually be a strength, to not like to fight. And I'm not stupid or weird for being afraid about hurting people. That meant a lot to have that option presented to me as a young person. And I think about that all the time when I'm working with kids, is like, they need to see possibility. They need to see that they're not weird, that they're not alone, and that whatever they're interested in, there is potential there. But there's work on the other side of that potential, but it's still, the potential is there. And I think, like, also as a kid who grew up in a rural area, it's like, to me, all these magical names in these comic books, they all looked like that painting of God on the Sistine Chapel. They were all these big, wise, bearded men who were going to speak in this big, low voice. And then when I finally met a lot of these guys, I was like, oh, they're just dudes, and they're really, really cool dudes. And I wish I would have met them sooner, because that would have given me a clue that this was something that I could be doing as a grown-up. I mean, I did anyway, but you know what I mean.
No, I know. I think, again, like, at this... At this comic festival, there are legions of children that are going to get to see that CC Bell is a person, and that John Green
is one of the sweetest.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that she'll bring her hearing aids that she, you know, used growing up, and that she shares in El Defo, and that's a thing to know, that, like, I'm not just reading a comic about a bunny, but I'm reading a comic about an experience. Yeah. And for all of that, it makes me, to bring it full circle, and I know that we weren't recording when you and I had this, we were talking prior, but the for as much of yourself that you pour into your comics jersey, and I know, I have to believe that you know this and the other cartoonists know this, but know that there are hundreds and thousands of kids that you're influencing from the characters in your comics and the choices they make and the way that kids literally see themselves as those characters. Because when we read comics, the character's voice is our voice and the character's face is our face. So they're seeing themselves in there, and they might never have the opportunity or the courage or whatever to say to your face how much they're influenced by your work. But Jersey, I can tell you, because I see it on their face, that the work you do and that your colleagues do means so much. And it means a lot to me as well, as a librarian and as a teacher, as a parent, to know that you spending all the time that you do and working to get things just right and to tell these stories and to stick to your morals and your beliefs in these great pacifist characters and things like that, Jersey, that it's influencing children and it's causing them to grow up to be different, and different for good. So thank you for being a force for good in their lives.
I don't even know how to respond to that. that's the hope anyway, you hope, you know, but I mean, yeah, I think about that responsibility as a storyteller, as somebody who just puts ideas out in the world all the time.
Yeah.
Because I was so affected by things, you know? So yeah, it's like, you know, I never know, but I'm at least going to be really responsible about it. I never want a kid to come up to me and tell me that my work meant something to them and then have me say, you know, I was just kind of phoning that in. You know, I always want to be able to say to them that, like, oh, I'm so glad because I was pouring my guts into that one.
No doubt.
Yeah.
And to be there and not shy away from how excited you are to meet them. You know, we were talking about the value of working with your head in the sand and not worrying about some of the noise that's up there. But my hope for you and for others is that when you come up for air, that you won't see or hear the distractions of social media, but somehow you'll see their faces, the faces of your readers, and know that they're here and they're waiting for you, and they can't wait to celebrate the next thing that you share with them. Because I mean, that's really, for me, it's that, it's such a sweet thing that it happens. But like, we read the whatever new book that we get in, the new Nathan Hale book that we got in, or the new whatever that gets turned into our library, doesn't even matter, whatever it is, whatever new comic, whatever new book that we have, those kids devour it so quickly. And immediately they ask, when's the next one coming out? You spend a year, 2 years making this thing, and it's a day later, when's the next thing coming out? But it's, that comes from such a beautiful place of love that I could only wish that I teach them in a class, and that they say, well, why can't we just ditch the rest of our school day and spend the day with you and still learn? that kind of quality that they just, kids just want to love. They just want to love, and they just want to, you know, have the things that they love near to them. That's a cool thing.
You summed it up perfectly. You said in your email to me, like, I might ask you, like, why you got into writing for kids. That's why. That is precisely why. Because it is absolutely unfiltered. It's unironic. It's unself-aware. It's just like, isn't this neat? It's like the way I had the privilege at a Comic-Con once of talking to two 12-year-olds or like 11-year-olds. And they actually knew about He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, the old show.
Whoa.
Yeah, like they were watching it on purpose on their own, you know? Yeah. And so, like, I got to talk to them about, like, who was the coolest bad guy, who was the coolest good guy, which was the best episode. And it was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me.
That's so cool. Okay, well, Jersey,
I got to talk about it in the right way.
Yes. Know? I want to contain this energy and give you the final word as we wrap up this recording. I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow. You know this. It's exciting. What message would you like me to bring them from you?
Okay. The only thing between you and making cool stuff is a whole bunch of effort, which sounds like a bum out. But that effort is a journey where you're going to meet some of the coolest people ever, and you will never regret it.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Lisa Brown returns to the podcast to share the Airport book, her newest picture book. And after that, Kelly Light shares Louise and Andy, The Art of Friendship, the sequel to her 2014 Louise Loves Art. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.